towards the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount, Yosha goes through this whole discussion about how nothing good comes from a bad tree, and nothing bad comes from a good tree. It's black and white. He's saying you ought not take the good and leave the bad. If you find someone whose writings or whose speech somehow resonates with you, if what they say is true, then it needs to be entirely true to be valuable. If what they say is false, if anything they say is false, then everything they say should be discarded. And he then concludes that with saying that in the end, none of those who are calling him Lord will be able to enter the kingdom of heaven, but only those who respond to the will of the Father. And it's really one of those very interesting realizations that as a Christian, if you're referring to God as the Lord, then you clearly don't know him. Then your God is very different than the real one. And what's the difference between having a relationship with a false God and having no relationship with God at all? I mean, there really is none. If you're so lost in terms of knowing who he is, if you've been so beguiled that you would refer to him as the Lord, you clearly do not know him. That's why Yosha said, no one calling me Lord, Lord, can enter the kingdom of heaven. No one. If you don't know his name, you do not know him. And if you're going to mistake him for a Lord, then you're so lost, you're actually having a relationship with the adversary, with Satan. You're just confusing Satan with God. You know, lords are those you have to obey. Lords establish rules. You worship lords. Lords do not operate within the parameters of free will. When the Roman Catholic Church, with Theodosius around 400 CE, made Christianity, Nicene Christianity, the official religion of the Roman Empire. Simultaneously, they established the feudal system of lord and serf that plagued Europe for 1,000 years thereafter. So these are things we ought to be cognizant of, that lords control. Lords don't offer freedom. The lords don't offer their subjects opportunity. Lords are controlling. Fathers lift up their children. Fathers nourish their children. Fathers try to make their children greater than they are. They do everything they can on behalf of their children. If you're referring to God as the Lord, you most certainly do not know him. And if you have a relationship with someone you call Jesus, you don't know him either. Because his real name is Yahusha. And that name explains exactly who he is and what he was doing. Now, after that, the next statement that Yosha makes is he's trying to enlighten Christians, those beguiled by Paul. And he says, you know, I know how you're going to respond, because this is what Paul's going to say in his letters, that, you know, you did all these great miracles in my name, and you established these religious institutions, and you drove out demons, and you were inspired to speak in my name. And boy, we've devoted ourselves to you. How in the world could you keep us out of heaven? In fact, to use his words, he says, they will say, on that day, Lord, Lord, didn't we speak inspired utterances in your name, cast out demons in your name, and establish mighty political and religious institutions in your name? But the answer to those questions is a resounding no. Not one Christian in a million knows or uses Yahusha's name. In fact, once a person comes to know his name and understand what it means, he or she can no longer be a Christian. And that is because Yahusha's name means Yahweh saves. And it means that salvation is found in the Torah and is offered by the Father, not in the Christian New Testament. You will not find a church anywhere on this planet where the sermon is delivered in Yahusha's name. Christians speak on behalf of Paul instead, and Paul's caricature of Jesus Christ. They are inspired by Pauline doctrine instead of Yahweh's Torah. In all of their many books, in all of their vast libraries, in all of their superficial Bible studies, in all of their thoughtless radio and television programs, in all of their religious institutions, they never speak or write in the name of God. Most don't even know it. As for driving out demons, which is a common claim, I get letters all the time from people saying, you can't tell me that I don't have a relationship with God just because I call him Jesus and Lord because, well, I've personally driven out demons. Oh, yeah, go. Yahusha did. But the moment you come to understand that Christian clerics, like Paul, are inspired by and manipulated by Satan, it's easy to see why they would be able to exorcise demons. The adversary controls both. So casting out demonic spirits becomes the perfect ruse. You know, there's this stupid idea that if you cast out a demon, that you've somehow put an end to that demon's ability to, you know, perform as a demon. But that's not true. Demons are simply fallen Moloch messengers. They're immortal. They're spiritual beings. They can't be killed. You can cast them out of an individual, but they're going to go and inhabit another. Or just go off and menace someone some other way. You can't put an end to them. So it's a perfect ruse. You know, if you have got somebody that appears to be slathering all over themselves and says, well, you know, I'm demon-possessed and has got all sorts of really ridiculous sayings, attitudes and approaches and all that sort of thing. In fact, at that point, it's actually in Satan's interest to have a exorcism performed by a religious person, because it provides undue credibility to the religious person, and a person that's demon-possessed in that way is not doing Satan any good. Satan doesn't want to be known as Satan. He doesn't want to be known as someone who will possess you and turn you into, you know, the little girl at the exorcist with guacamole coming out of your mouth. That's not how he wants to be known. Satan never wants to be worshipped as the devil. He does not want to be known as the adversary. He wants to be worshipped as the Lord. He wants people to mistake him for God. So easily confused by this sleight of hand, it is reasonable to assume that Christians will be making this claim to validate their godly credentials. Paul did. But Yahusha is translated suggesting that they will have professed to throwing out inferior gods and pagan deities. What's funny about this, and that's Daemonian in Greek, is the possibility is that Paul's strategy was to replace Yahweh with Iesu Christu, thereby demoting the inferior and impotent God of the obsolete and arcane Old Testament, quoting Paul's introduction to Galatians, with an all-accepting, always nice, graceful God of his superior New Testament. In actuality, knowing that the only real God was replaced by faith in the gospel of grace, the evil spells of the pagan goddess. Now, it is indeed interesting, and I've just completed a study of how it was even remotely possible that a religion like Christianity could be foisted on the world. I mean, here's a religion that's allegedly predicated on a Hebrew text, and yet it despises that Hebrew text. Here's a religion that is allegedly based upon a series of descendants of Abraham, of Yishak, and of Jacob, who became Yisrael, and the 12 tribes of Yisrael, and with all of the prophets being Yisraelites, being Yehudim, being Jews, to use today's parlance. And yet it's anti-Semitic. Here's a religion that claims to be based on this individual who they misnamed, Jesus Christ, who had a Hebrew name, who had a Hebrew title, who was clearly Hebrew. Yet they, to create their religion, have to disdain all things Hebrew, be stunningly anti-Semitic. Here's a God that says that the earth is good, the flesh is good, animals, when he creates them, are good. Man is good as conceived in the flesh, and yet it's a religion that says the flesh is evil. Now, how is it possible to have a religion that out of touch with its own history? I mean, you had to create an entirely artificial place to establish this religion, completely disjoined from everything in its past. And when you recognize that that's what was required for Paul's letters to prevail and for Christianity to begin as a religion, that you had to have a completely artificial means of grounding the religion because you had completely ripped it roots right out of the land in which it was grown, you come to realize that Greece was, and the Greek influence that was permeated around the world through the conquest of Alexander the Great, was the means to this end. That the Greeks were almost universally Gnostics. And Gnosticism is the religion that was promoted by Plato. You know, of the real world being inferior. And there being a spiritual world, another world, a perfect world out there that didn't have all of the flaws of the material world. Alexander the Great's tutor, Aristotle, was a Gnostic and promoted this same mindset. And what you realize is that Paul's attack on the Torah, with the Torah being flesh, and the covenant being of the flesh, and circumcision, the sign of the covenant being of the flesh, and all those things are evil, so that faith and this nebulous and spiritual realm of belief in the gospel of grace was somehow the answer. Well, if it hadn't been for Gnosticism in Greek culture, it wouldn't have fly. We're talking about what kind of culture had to exist in Greece for Paul's mythos of of the flesh being evil and circumcision and the Torah and its covenant being evil and of the flesh, and for his new idea, his gospel of grace to be of the Spirit and to be good, and he's speaking the same language that Plato spoke. It's the same thing that Aristotle taught. It's the same thing that Alexander the Great distributed around the known world. And that's half of the story. The other half of the story is that the Greeks had a ready-made God, perfect for the caricature of the Pauline Iusiu Christou. And that caricature was, a mythological character, was Dionysus. And if you consider the similarities between the Greek Dionysus, a Roman god's name was Bacchus. In Egypt, he was Osiris. In Babylon, he was Tammuz. He was the son of the father of the gods. With Dionysus, he had a mortal mother who was taken as a virgin. Every aspect of Dionysus' cult mirrors the Christian caricature of Iusu Christu, Jesus Christ. And had it not been for the cult of Dionysus and the philosophical religious culture of Gnosticism, There is no way that you could have promoted a religion this disjointed from its own past and prevailed. But the Greeks were receptive for these reasons and more. Now, as we continue to consider Yahweh's testimony, he's translated into Greek saying polos dynamis, which, while I translated many mighty and miraculous things, could just have accurately have been rendered extensive political and religious institutions. Satan's minions do both, but they're better at establishing the latter. So it will come as a tremendous shock to the systems of Christians when they learn that their institutions, their churches, their godly nations, their denominations were not established in the name of God. In fact, have no relationship to God whatsoever. In fact, are even adversarial to him. Further, mighty deeds and miracles are so often claimed by those inspired by the adversary that Yahweh actually tells us that when we see them, we ought to be especially wary. You see, God doesn't show off. Yahweh isn't a show off, but Satan is. So when you see mighty miracles, rather than saying, wow, that person must have a direct pipeline to God's capabilities, you ought to see exactly the opposite. It's Satan showing off. Yahweh isn't a show off. Yahweh communicates through his words. You'll find him there, quietly, privately. You aren't going to find him showing off in public. It's just not what he does. Not his style. God does not have to prove his status or power, and doesn't, but Satan does. Moreover, Christians almost universally claim that their lives or those that they have been miraculous, that their lives or their loved ones somehow have been miraculously transformed, something, of course, they errantly attribute to God. So Yahusha is telling them that these things are neither proof nor are they valid. They're neither good nor appropriate. In an informed and rational world, Yahusha's conclusion would have scuttled Pauline doctrine and destroyed the religion of Christianity with it. And it's ironic that Christians believe that their religion was created by the individual who cratered it years before it was born. This is Yahusha speaking to Christians. He said, "And then I will profess to them that because I never at any time knew you, you must all depart from me, those of you involved in Torahlessness." The word anomenia is based upon nomos. Nomia is a derivative of nomos, and in Greek, when you put the A in front of a word, it negates it. So throughout the Septuagint, for example, hundreds of times when in Hebrew you read Torah, it will be replaced, translated into Greek, Torah, into nomos. And here this is the negation of nomos, representing the Torah. So God is saying you are without the Torah. Oops. Let me share with you something I said before the break. In an informed and rational world, Yahusha's conclusion here at the terminus of his Sermon on the Mount, since it scuttled Pauline doctrine, since it completely destroyed the religion of Christianity with this next statement, isn't it ironic that Christians still believe that their religion was created by the individual who destroyed it before it was born? He said this, "And then I will profess to them." These are the Christians that are saying, they call him Lord. They're saying these are have to be Christians because they're the ones that claim that they are doing mighty miracles, casting out demons, and building mighty institutions in his name. This is his name, Yahusha. And therefore, these are the Christians who, you know, claim that they even name themselves after, a Greek rendering of his title. call themselves Christians, says they are followers of Jesus. They're building all these things in Jesus' name. And then I will profess to them that because I never at any time knew you, you must depart from me, all of you who were involved in the negation of the Torah. Whoa. I mean, full stop. If you're a Christian, that's a death knell on your religion. The God who you believe was given a new name, Jesus Christ, says he never knew you. Doesn't have a clue who you are. Doesn't even have an interest in who you are. And he's not saying, oh, but you know, you have a really nice heart. You did some nice things. I think I'm going to cut you a deal here. I'm going to let you in. No, that's not what he says. He says, get away from me. Get away from me. All of you who are involved in Torahlessness. It's 100% of Christians. They're Torahless. The moment you observe the Torah, you cease to be a Christian. As a matter of fact, the moment you follow Yahusha, you know, you actually come to know what his name is. And you start to say, you know, I'm going to follow his example. You're going to be Torah observant the moment you follow his example, because he was Torah observant. The moment you're Torah observant, you cease to be a Christian. By the way, Yahusha doesn't even want us to follow his example. He wants us to observe the Torah, but he never asks us to follow his example. Fine. You know, if you look at the people who are presented, communicated on behalf of God, with the exception of the diminished manifestation of God himself, Yahusha, they're all flawed characters. Not a single one of Yahweh's prophets says, follow my example. You certainly can't do it with Dod, who's the God's actually favorite guy, David. And he was a rascal. Moshe doesn't say, Moses doesn't say, follow my example. None of the prophets say, follow my example. Yahusha didn't say, follow my example. God's instruction to us, what he's interested in, is for us to observe his Torah, for us to listen to him. He then tells us what's important for us to know. He introduces himself to us. He proves his existence. And he then delineates the terms and conditions for us to participate in the covenant. It's then up to us to decide, do we wish to do so or not? And then, once we do so, we're not really even at that point following anybody. At that point, we are liberated. We're free. We're like children growing up in a loving family. The children don't follow their father. They are free to explore. In fact, it is good when they go out and explore. And the father might follow them on a camping trip or, you know, into some new exciting pastime that is rewarding and fun. It's not about following. It's about becoming part of the family and enjoying being part of the family. But the only way to be part of the family is to be involved in the Torah. The only way you have a chance of knowing who God is and have him never say of you, I never knew you, the only way you can avoid that is to observe the Torah, to listen to what God has to say in his Torah teaching. When you are with the Torah as opposed to being without the Torah, you come to know who he is. And when you come to know who he is, he comes to know who you are. God knows his children. He takes care of his children. And rather than hearing, get away from me, you must depart from me, what the father tells his children is, come unto me. Come. You're welcome in my home. You're welcome in my universe. In fact, let's go out and explore this universe together. But the only way you can get there is through the Torah. So if you're without the Torah, which is the basis of Christianity, is its disdain of the Torah, that it claims to be liberated from the Torah. If you are liberated from the Torah, you can't know who God is. It's impossible. You can't participate in the covenant because you don't know its terms and conditions without the Torah. You can't attend the meetings that God has established for us 7 times a year without the Torah. You don't know what they're for. You don't even know that you've been invited. The moment you take the Torah away, you take God away. And that's why he's saying, I never knew you, not at any time. You must all depart from me. And I get so many letters from people. You say, you can't tell me that I don't have a relationship with God. You can't tell me that I don't have a relationship with him. Oh, yeah, I can. And Yahweh will. If you're of this misconception that there was a Jesus Christ, if you're of the misconception that he created a religion, if you're of the misconception that he did away with the Torah, if you're of the misconception the Torah does not apply to your life, if you're of the misconception that God wants to be called Lord, if you're of the misconception that God does not have a name, if you're under the misconception that Paul was inspired to contradict the very God that he claimed inspired him, then you don't know him. He doesn't know you. You aren't saved. And as a matter of fact, in all of this, the thing that's really important is God didn't say, I'm damning you to hell. He didn't say that, did he? He just said, get away from me. I don't know you. You must depart from me. I don't know you. Think about that. You must know him and he must know you for you to be able to be with him. And the penalty for not knowing him isn't damnation. It's just, you're not welcome in my presence. Not welcome. No heaven. You missed the door. There is a doorway. It's called Passover. You don't observe Passover. You aren't going through that door. There's a welcome mat to heaven. It's called matzah. If you're not scrubbed clean on matzah, you're not going in. You're not going to color up God's house. You know, the third of the appointed meetings that God has established is called firstborn children. If you're not availing yourself of adoption into his family, then you're not welcome in his home. Now, the thing that's important here is God's not talking about salvation. He's talking about relationship. It's another thing that Christians, of course, get wrong so much of the time. It's the reason that what Don said last week resonates so strongly, so profoundly with me. And I know it also does with Kirk, who was just called in. It's all about adoption, being part of his family, and then God takes care of his children. He didn't say here, you're not saved. He just said, get away from me. You're not part of my family. Hi, Kirk.
How are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful.
I had to step out. I'm catching you in between. I had to step out and take my dog to the vet, but I was a little bit early before we had to leave. Nick was on the line about checking out sources, you know, to verify things
right.
For himself.
Yes.
And I was just going to point out that one of the things that I did over the last 6 years was we got a hold to the ancient Hebrew dictionary and an ancient Hebrew Torah and an ancient Hebrew lexicon, which has all of the words as well as the Torah and everything. But it also has them where you can not only translate it from current Hebrew to English, but you can also go back to the ancient Hebrew with all the icons. You can verify not only every word, you can verify every letter and all the meanings, which you did on a program one time, which I followed along with you and also done myself, where you take each word and you break it down to every letter and get every meaning for every letter, And all this stuff is verifiable if anybody, but you got to work for it.
You do have to work for it. What Kirk is talking about here is really important, and that is that the original language, not the language, the alphabet, the language is the same, Hebrew. The original alphabet that was used to write the Torah and to describe the Ten Statements that Yahweh etched in stone was a pictographic alphabet, so that each letter, each of the 22 letters of the pictographic alphabet conveyed meaning. And therefore, during a time that you didn't have lexicons and dictionaries, even during a time when many people were illiterate, you could read and understand what was being said just by looking at the pictures. And so what you're talking about is a tool that takes every one of the Hebrew words back to their original pictures and enables you to look at the pictures and determine what the word means without any other tool. You know, I think you know that in the opening volume of Intro to God, I present that entire pictographic alphabet and describe what each word means, and then I take some 20 important Hebrew words and then walk the reader through how you apply those pictures of things like the staff, like teeth, like two people standing up and reaching up, like an arm reaching down and out with an open hand. How you apply those images to understand the words. Please stay with us, Kirk, and we'll talk about this some more when we return after the final commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Kirk is saying something here that really is quite profound, and that is that Yahweh made it possible for anyone who is interested in verifying his testimony to do so on their own without any great degree of skill, just by looking at the letters that were used to write everything that he had to say. Kirk, you mentioned that you had a tool that you had acquired for this purpose. What is that tool?
Well, this is an ancient Hebrew lexicon by Benner. And then he also put out a ancient Hebrew dictionary that has 1,000 verbs and nouns. And
okay.
He has a lot of stuff. But
is this the site that the guy that provides the you can actually get the script, you can download the ancient Hebrew scripts, and he shows you a variety of Hebrew scripts over time. And,
oh, probably. He has a lot of that in his books. I'm more. I have to see it rather than, I'm not very good on a computer, so to me I need something like a book that's more tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he did throw in something in his thing.
And by the way, so you bought two of his books?
I bought three of those and a few other things from, we have all the other ones, some of the other ones that you've mentioned in your list, you know, just to verify things, plus we always get strong.
And kind of just as a ballpark.
I've been taken to the cleaners by all the Christians, so after so many years, so I figured we'd verify this.
I'm glad you did. How much, do you have any ideas approximately how much you spent by buying the three books that gave you some verbs, the alphabet itself, so you could, because, by the way, once you know, you could look at the English transliterations that you find in the books that I've written, and it's really easy to replace those letters with the pictographic letters. So you don't actually have to buy these books to be able to do that. Use the charts that I have, which are all free. But how much money do you spend on these three books approximately?
I doubt if it was too much over $100 on those.
Okay, so it's not a lot of money to understand what God was saying more clearly.
Sure, sure. Now, one thing I wanted, there was a wrinkle in there that I had not thought of that he does mention, and I've been reading on this recently. The ancient Hebrew language is also built on things that are very concrete in the sense that all the words are related to feeling and smelling and touching and hearing and so forth, whereas the Greek, as you know, is more philosophical.
Right.
So a lot of the words that we, in English, they translate, they add a Greek bend on it as opposed to the ancient thought. So once you get back into the head of the ancient Hebrews, then it also, you have to keep that in mind when you translate it as well.
Yeah, in fact, the reason for this, and they just do a little speculation here, is that God was really into observation. He wants us to be observant. That's why he gave us a soul and then a nesama to be able to use our good judgment to then make sense of what we were observing. You observe that which is tangible. And so God is communicating with us in very concrete terms. And he doesn't want to go into human philosophy. He instead is, these are very concrete terms. So I don't think there is anything more concrete in our world than the understanding of a loving family of men and women coming together as husband and wife, becoming mother and father, conceiving and raising children in a home. It's a very concrete, tangible concept. And his alphabet was designed to communicate family, home, mother, father, coming together in love and reaching out to their children to lift them up. In fact, I've just described Yahweh's name. As it's written in that language.
In that language, right.
Yeah. Actually, that alphabet is the same Hebrew language. It's just an alphabet that provides its own dictionary.
Yeah, and then they went off, of course, and changed everything from the Babylonian days, and they brought all that in.
Yeah, now the reason the Greek went into the philosophical is that because the Greeks philosophy, conceived initially by Plato, promoted by Plato, was that that which was tangible, that which was real, was corrupt and evil. And that the only thing that was good was that which was this mysterious other world out there. The world they could not see was perfect, while the tangible was flawed. That's the opposite philosophy that God is creating. He said, I created this world. I like it. I think it's good. There's nothing wrong with the tangible, with the material, with the flesh.
What's wrong with us?
Yeah, what's wrong with us? He created us. He rather likes us. And so it's a fundamental difference. And yes, so many English words are derived from Greek and not from Hebrew. And you get right back into it. The more you can put yourself in a Hebrew mindset, the easier God is to understand. Well, Kirk, I wish we had more time. I want to please encourage you to call back in tomorrow's program, and we can deal with this even more. In fact, if you'll send me the specific books that you've purchased and which ones you recommend, we'll share that information.